And of course, also the chance to be at the frontier of a new tech and be also like a bridge builder, because I'm not a techie. I'm not a missionary here. I'm more like a bridge builder. And this is really what motivates me. And I hope that's what I can bring as added value to my clients, to the projects, to the ecosystem.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I am the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Kevin Luthart from 3K.co, who specializes in helping companies with, well, I'll let Kevin explain what he does, but what we are going to do today is talk about crypto in the balance sheet. Crypto has had a storied existence for the last 10 years, but you may have thought that it had gone away, but it definitely hasn't. And if you're ignoring it, you may be missing out on opportunities in your finance team. Kevin, thanks very much for coming to the show today. I'm going to open things up just by asking, tell us one thing that about yourself that nobody knows.
Yeah, no, thanks, first of all, James, for being on the pod here. It's a great opportunity and, of course, joy to have this conversation today. And coming back to your question, of course, not a simple question, but maybe I'm actually a pretty big airline freak or aviation geek. So I'm a frequent user of Flight Radar 24, for example, and other platforms just to see what's going on in the air. I can spend hours and evenings on this. So that may be something not everybody or not so many people are aware of, but I think it makes a lot of sense because as a finance guy, you often find yourself in a cockpit. So I think that's where a lot of things, again, resonate and make sense.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, cool. I've got a friend who also is into the weather and airplanes and what's happening all the time. And he's like, it's fascinating. And we had that issue with Elon Musk getting tracked recently, right? Is that on Flight Radar? Is that what you could use?
Yeah, I think that was there where I think one of his, or I don't know how many he's got, but like one of his plane was basically tracked. And yeah, you can actually, because it's using a lot of open source data, you can follow quite some interesting patterns. Also, especially, that's maybe a bit a more serious comment, like in current days where, of course, a lot of tensions are across the globe visible. You often see them also mirrored in actual flight patterns. And in that sense, it's also a way to kind of like contrast what you read to see what actually happens real time in the air.
Well, interesting. Okay, so there was recently all the flights over Iran were cancelled, and then you could log in and say, oh yeah, it's really in live time. You can see that's really happening, and you can, wow.
Absolutely. And you saw like then how flights were derouted exactly because of these circumstances.
Yeah, I wish I hadn't found out about this because I'm a bit of a geek for stuff like this. And I feel like coffee was my last obsession, but I feel like I could get into this. But let's keep things on track anyway. So maybe, yeah, Kevin, maybe you can just give us a bit of background on 3K, how you came to be here, and tell us a bit about your work history so far.
Yeah, no, with pleasure. Yeah, originally, I'm Swiss. I'm basically out of Zurich, Switzerland. I used to work as a tax lawyer after my business school studies. That's also where in 2017, I got in touch with crypto from a professional point of view, as I was then part of an advisory group focusing on providing tax, legal, regulatory advice to token issuing projects, or projects which basically launched a coin, a digital asset at that time. And I basically stayed, right? With the difference or the nuance that I decided then it was 2019, if I'm not mistaken, to actually move in-house. So I moved over to a crypto project, a startup company, and I basically stayed there for roughly 4 years. Mm-hmm. And of course, learned a lot, got a lot of the challenges to resolve, etc. It was a fun time, but I also realized at some point, well, it's such a nascent industry. Many external legal, tax, accounting advisors are also pretty new to this industry. So that could be a niche. And out of that basically consideration and thinking, I basically created the idea of setting up my own shop. And that's basically what I did roughly a year ago by setting up 3K, 3 Web3, which is basically a summary term for all application in the cryptosphere. And K stands for my first name. So the first letter of my first name, Kevin. That's how I came up. And I basically, since roughly a year ago, I run this as a solo advisory practice, very hands-on, working with projects in a fractional CFO capacity, navigating all the fund, finance, accounting challenges, tax challenges this industry brings along. And especially, I think what really drives me and really wakes me every morning. So it's really, first of all, it's a very high-paced industry. It's very international. So there's not just a Swiss view. It's usually you're always confronted with a lot of different influences. And yeah, just like a great diversity of people, backgrounds. And of course, also like, the chance to support, to be at the frontier of a new tech and be also like a bridge builder, because I'm not a techie. I'm not a missionary here. I'm like more like a bridge builder. And this is really what motivates me. And I hope that's what I can bring as like added value to my clients, to the projects, to the ecosystem.
Okay. Well, I hope by the end of this conversation, people have a better idea about how it can practically be used in real business. So I guess 2019 would have been the top of the crypto hype cycle. I was in the SaaS hype cycle just before that. And then crypto came along and all the SaaS people weren't cool anymore. And now AI has come along and sidelined both of us. But some things have really changed in crypto in the last year. We now have ETFs traded for Bitcoin. That's really, I guess that's the first time a lot of people would have added a lot of credibility to this. You know, it's become not just something for the tech bros anymore, and it's maturing a little bit. And I think a lot of people, including me, would have thought, well, crypto is over, but perhaps we're missing a trick, like if we are just ignoring crypto, because the fundamental technology has some very interesting applications. But famously, you know, there's that quadrant out there of useful and legal things that you can use with crypto, and then everything else, which we all know about. So let's start there. What are the most common useful legal use cases for holding crypto on your balance sheet in the first place?
Yeah, I think this is a super relevant question, because like, right, every day, of course, I'm very much in this bubble, so to say, and it's very important to step out of this bubble from time to time and exactly ask this question. And I would say, so far as of today, some people might disagree, but I see basically we have two validated use case for crypto. I think the first one is probably pretty well known. It's the concept, or it's the use case of value storage. This is to me like the success story of Bitcoin. I think if you look also like today, I think the Bitcoin is currently trading close to $70,000, so very close to an all-time high. I think it's fair to say, although of course there are also still some critical voices out there, that Bitcoin becomes more and more something like the digital gold. I think that's certainly something, if you look at historical transaction data, if you use how it is used, how also now, thanks to, for example, this exchange traded products, right? Also the institutional sector is moving into these categories. This is certainly, I think, a strong validation there. Of course, there's still a long way to go, but that's one. So this value storage concept for Bitcoin. The second one, it's a rather emerging one, for which actually I have higher hopes, because in my view, it's way more interesting for entrepreneurs and businesses. It's actually really what we could now call that the so-called stable coins. So right, these are digital assets, which are basically pegged to literal actual, for example, dollars, euros, or other legal tenders, that they have reached somehow product market fit. What do I mean by that? Very interesting, and I think maybe it comes very handy for this podcast. Andreessen Horowitz, so the crypto team, they are one of the leading venture capitalists in this industry. They launched last week a state of industry report, where they basically outlined that, and I was not actually aware of that, that in Q2 2024, the amount of transactions in stablecoin was about twice the size of the transaction on Visa credit cards. So we see a quite impressive catch up in number of transactions and transaction volume, which kind of provides for a confirmation that we have reached product market fit for stablecoins. And why are stablecoins super interesting? Because they allow for automated, reliable payments at a relatively low cost of transaction. What do I mean by that? If you think about, if you are a European business, somewhere established in the SEPA region, and you want to do a transfer, let's say the US, usually the transaction fees are pretty exorbitant. There can be, of course, like if it's a small amount, maybe we talk about a few dollars, euros, but if it's a sizable amount, can really get as close to, I have also experienced that myself, like 0.1% of the transaction value, which is horrific if you don't anticipate such a fee. And what have by now, as of today, stablecoins resolved, depending on the setup, depending, and I will not go into the very technical, but it's now possible to make such cross-border, because it's in the web, right? It doesn't matter whether it's now a domestic or a cross-border transaction.
Sure.
You can arrange such a transfer at a transaction cost level, which can come down to as little as $1. And I think this is, to me, like really the power of the stable payments and the use of the stable coins. It's quick. Mm-hmm. So we don't talk, and that's another aspect I haven't yet mentioned. We don't talk about like 3-4 days until it's settled. We talk about a few minutes.
Right.
And also at relatively low transaction fees. Of course, there's a big but. The but is tied to the fact that, of course, in order to basically benefit from such offers, you need to be in crypto, need to have, of course, like, the infrastructure, like a wallet, like an account with an exchange to basically receive and make such payments. But this is, I think, these two, like Bitcoin and stable coins, these two categories, I would consider as really very insightful to showcase the adoption we have achieved with crypto, which is also relevant for mainstream.
Okay, well, that's a very good framework there to bring the conversation down. So we have two categories, value store and fast, cheap transactions, I guess. So let's start off with value store. Famously, Bitcoin is extremely volatile. And two-part question, do you foresee that? Because it's often mentioned in the same category as gold, as a sort of a hedge against depression, or, you know, people are sometimes they're calling Bitcoin the modern gold as a way of hedging against a crash in the stock market, for example. But so if it's so volatile, how can it be a value store? Because you're never really sure how you're going to get what you're going to get out of it when you need it.
No, that's absolutely an appropriate question. And I would say, like, it's not yet fully maturized. I think it still has to go away. I think what definitely speaks for it is there's a capped supply, right? So there's not, it cannot grow beyond a certain limit. So I think which really makes it at some point a scarce resource. Certainly what is, I think, a game changer, or potentially a game changer, is really now the arrival of the institutions. Like because in the past, of course, like banks, insurance companies, trading companies in particular, they showed already some interest in Bitcoin as an asset category. Mm. But for various reasons, be it operational reasons, but also regulatory reasons, they were not able to set up, for example, the custody operations themselves. And I think the introduction now of this ETFs or ETPs really can be potentially in the long run a game changer. And if you also look at the inflow into this product, so far it has confirmed. And as always, right? And I think I would also apply a similar view on an instrument like gold, right? It's not the idea that you move all your savings into Bitcoin. It's just probably something which can enrich your portfolio. It's a further instrument which can help you to further diversify your investments, your portfolio. And also maybe something quite interesting to observe since probably the last like 18 months, also like further fueled by the introduction of these products like ETF and ETP products, you see also like that there's a higher correlation degree between traditional markets, for example, like a NASDAQ and the Bitcoin moves. Because, of course, you have now more and more same holders or mutual holders. And, of course, they take decisions upon similar or the same criteria. But you're absolutely right. Like, we are not yet there where it can be fully compared. But there is a hope, given also now this institutional adoption, that it moves more and more into direction of fulfilling this prophecy, so to say.
Okay. So for most businesses, then, this is not something as a value store you're going to have to worry about soon. But you may, let's say, for example, you know, you want to hold it in your business for some reason. What are the practical, things you have to be aware of if you're going to start to put Bitcoin on your balance sheet from an accounting and a tax perspective? Are you opening yourself up to certain risks by having this volatile asset on your balance sheet? And how do you even mark it to market? What are the things you have to think about from an accounting perspective?
Yeah, there are definitely a few considerations to be made, right? And I think just as an introduction example, because it's a public example, there's a US listed company called MicroStrategy. Its founders, Michael Saylor, he actually decided a couple of years ago to move quite some of the company into Bitcoin. And of course, he made a pretty good job since then.
But he was just an ERP provider or something. Totally.
Exactly.
They had a bunch of cash on the balance sheet. And they were like, what are we going to do? And says, we're just going to turn into a Bitcoin investment, speculate on Bitcoin, more or less. And he holds some huge proportion of it. Massive.
Absolutely. And this is exactly the point I wanted to do, to why I brought it up. Essentially, I've read then, and also this is no investment advice here, right? It's just like an illustration of our thinking here and our discussion, and that people started actually buying the stock, not because of the business, but rather actually as a proxy to get an exposure to Bitcoin. So why do I mention this? Yeah, if you now, of course, start as a business moving certain cash reserves into the Bitcoin, also think about how this kind of like impacts maybe the outside relationships you have, like your shareholders, your partners, because that, of course, given this volatility, also change a bit like how people look at you. And now coming back, right, what does it mean if you basically own Bitcoin as a business? And of course, it first starts with the question, how do you actually keep it? How do you custody it? And there, of course, then, let's say, the more the pro approach, that you basically come up with so-called self-custodial setups. So, for example, hardware ledgers where you keep it, or like, and that's not necessarily recommended, like also like browser extensions. Or you work with, let's say, established crypto exchanges and broker companies. I will not use names because it should be not an ad placement here, but you will certainly find plenty of them in the space. And those are some are already by now regulated. And you basically keep your holdings via these institutions, which comes, of course, with an additional counterparty risk, because usually, unlike banks, you cannot benefit from at the same level of protection as a customer. And so, yeah, that's the first question. How do you keep it? How do you safekeep physically? Because, you need to be ready to receive it. Right. And then, of course, the question is, what happens in your balance sheet? What happens in your P&L?
Yeah.
And the first question is, what do we look at? And I was able to be involved in Switzerland in co-drafting certain initial accounting guidelines on crypto assets like Bitcoin. And of course, there's not a final take how you should treat your Bitcoin in the balance sheet, but there are multiple ways. And I think they're of a general nature. That's why I think I can bring it up. Do we look at the Bitcoin like something like cash or cash equivalents? Do we look at it as an inventory? Depending on the nature of your business. So, of course, like if you are a SaaS business, right, and you just decide to move certain liquidity into Bitcoin, the use or the categorization of your Bitcoin as an inventory holding might be potentially not the right fit. Is it intellectual property? Is it something should you look at it like a security?
And okay. What are the impacts of those decisions? So if it's intellectual property, then I guess you can, I don't know, what's the impact of deciding it's inventory versus intellectual property versus cash?
It's first of all, it affects where it's displayed on your balance sheet. Right.
Yeah,
because very simple nuances, like, do we talk about rather short-term holdings, so current assets, or do we talk about long-term holdings, more like fixed assets? And also, and given that differentiation, we have, of course, different valuation methodologies. And for example, like if you keep something as cash equivalent or also as inventory, usually you need to basically value these assets at market, if there's an available market, which... Right. In case of a highly volatile asset, brings a lot of P&L effects with it as a consequence. And then, depending, of course, on which standard you need to publish your books, right, or you need to draft your books, it's maybe not so preferred to have such a heavy load of volatility in your P&L.
Sure.
Because that also brings up, especially if you now think about you are, let's say, a SaaS business, right? And you have your ongoing business activity. You might have taken up a loan from your local bank to for example, like fund a new office move or relocation. And through this arrangement, you might have some covenants you need to basically comply with, right? And let's say your banker asked you, hey, please send me every quarter unaudited financial statements. If you now, let's say, move a large and let's say a significant portion of your cash flow in Bitcoin, and you start showcasing all this up and down in your P&L, maybe your banker might get worried. Like, because usually, and disclaimer, I was never working as a banker, and I'm not unhappy about this.
Yeah.
Just as a joke. they usually tend to not really be great fans of volatility, right? They want to have, they want to see steady flow, steady data they can easily reconcile. And that's why, like, this is really something you need to be aware of. Or also, like, for example, in Switzerland, I don't know where this is applicable in other jurisdictions, but it might be like, for example, you have a special tax, general tax deduction applicable on inventory. So if you now start booking all your crypto as inventory, maybe then in a tax audit, you also get confronted with the question, is that actually the right treatment? Do you really use it as a business, as a, something like an inventory? Is it really appropriate that you claim this deduction? And at first, I also thought, yeah, well, this valuation topics, they can't be that significant. But even, and I think we published this guidelines, it was 2018-ish. Together with the body which basically works in Switzerland on the general principle behind, let's say, gap accounting.
Yeah.
But it's still, as until today, it's still a key topic. And I was just speaking last week to a friend who was exactly dealing with such topics and consideration. It's still until today a key topic, how to deal with crypto from a categorization and, as a consequence, valuation point of view. And now you might ask yourself, okay, nice. So it gets even more complex. I don't have any certainty. There are only soft guidelines available.
Right.
Yeah. But in my experience, what it always helps is, because you need to know the authorities, the auditors, they don't have more clarity on this. And it's important to mention, it's not illegal what you do if you get into crypto, but it's just very rewarding to make up your mind early as a business owner, how to come up with an accounting guideline for your crypto holdings.
Okay.
This does not need to be super complex, but that you can just, as you then walk into tax audits, as you walk into discussion with your banker, have that you have a methodology to present. Why are you booking certain assets like this? And why you, for example, market or price certain assets like that.
Okay, so technically then when you're reporting this, so right now in my P&L, I think I have bank revaluations and I have currency fluctuations and we put them in the EBITDA section of our P&L. So you put them down there, whatever you call a crypto revaluation or similar, and you put it down there below your operating income, I guess. And that's how you report on it. And then so far, I think we've scared everyone off, right? So it's very volatile. It causes all these questions. It will get you in trouble with your covenants. If you're still the last man standing, Kevin, I'm sure you will help these people who still want to do it after this, but there's got to be a very specialized case. But I think the second half of the conversation, which is around, you know, using it as a for payments, is a lot more germane and a lot more active. And maybe it's, you know, it's a mistake to conflate these two things when there's one part that is very different to the other. So let's flip over to, you know, using it for payments, which is something that businesses do every day and we all pay very heavy fees for, especially if you're transferring internationally. So let's talk about some of the use cases for paying using crypto.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think you made here a very important different comment on that this really is a different, let's say, spectrum, or we enter a different spectrum with the stable coins. And maybe as a quick refresher, like what's again like a stable coin? Basically, you have a company like, for example, the USDC stablecoin, one of the leading ones. You have like a company, if I'm not mistaken, it's called Circle Financial, which basically, if you give them, simply speaking, a dollar, they will give you one USDC. So you have always like this option to redeem your USDC for $1. Mm. So it's not, let's say, a central bank who offers you this, but like it's a private company. And through that, basically, if you want to use as a business USDC, either for paying your vendors or as a accepting this currency as a means of payment for your services, in the end, in the balance sheet, of course, as long as this relationship is intact with, let's say, this issue of this stable coin, so I can maybe expand into this in a bit, it looks like actually very similar to a dollar in your balance sheet, because as it is backed by one USDC is basically at least backed by a dollar behind. It is basically pretty stable in its value. And all the volatility, which basically triggered all these discussions we had before, is basically gone, limited to a very minimal level.
Right. Now, there was some controversy, was it with Tether or because some of these companies, so it's important to understand you're basically buying into a private company at some level here. Like, so what level of security, either technical or whatever, because I believe there was a stable coin that became not so stable a couple of years ago, if I'm not familiar, that they started to, is it backed by an actual dollar somewhere or is that true or not?
Yeah, no, this is a very important question. And of course, like, like in the beginning, there was a lot of intransparency because like it's basically private companies offering the issue, this swap, so to say, of real dollars into this digital dollars. There was then at the time, and I think we talk now roughly 1.5 years ago, right, as Silicon Valley Bank got busted, there was a huge concern that in case of the USDC, that a large amount of basically the reserve that this private company kept were affected or exposed to the Silicon Valley Bank. Because as part of bringing more transparency into the scene, the stablecoins issuer started publishing reserves reports on at least, I think, quarterly basis. And they also started engaging traditional audit companies like Big Four companies, Big Five, Big Six companies. And in these reports, in one of the past reports, there was a statement that a certain part was actually held directly or indirectly. I would have to look up the details. Were held with Silicon Valley Bank. And of course, that brought up the concern, oh my God, yeah, well, probably my claim, right, to claim back my dollar is no longer backed by 100% through these reserves. And that led then, vividly recall this Friday late afternoon, to a de-pecking of this cryptocurrency by roughly, if I'm not mistaken, 10-12%, which is pretty enormous. If you think about that, of course, these private companies, what they do, they receive the dollars, they put it basically in money market instruments with other banks and just institutions.
And long-term bonds, that was the problem,
right? Yeah, long-term bonds, right. And given, of course, that they reacted also to market pricing, they had to adjust. And that led kind of like to this de-peg event. And that's probably the worst what can happen to a stablecoin because it's no longer obviously considered as being fully backed. And that, of course, puts also a certain, its purpose at absurdum to some extent. But it recovered then well. And since then, I'm not aware of any incident with that particular coin. But of course, right, also with others, there were various incidents in the past where, especially with then very complex models, how they also synthetically backed, let's say, this claim, where they had some issues with valuation, et cetera, et cetera, and pricing, which led them to even further decays of the peg. But I think, in all fairness, if we talk about the mainstream stablecoins, that was probably the major incident. And like I said, the other stuff would be a bit too crypto-focused to go into.
Okay. The big mitigating factor there is that if you're using it for payments, you only need to hold the stablecoin for a short period of time, right? You're no longer putting it on your balance sheet. You can literally hold it in euros, or French or Swiss francs, and then instantaneously, almost within a few minutes, have it transferred over to dollars, and you're really no exposure. Just check the whatever finance.yahoo.com before you do it, maybe. So we're not really exposed to as much of that risk like we would have been if we were holding it as a stable, as a value store, if you like. So that, you know, will give people a lot of comfort because, you know, the significant fees you pay for the alternative, you know, paying through Chase and all the rest, and even the specialized transfers. So what are the practical... Okay, so... let's just walk through, actually, one thing I want to ask you before we get into that, because you mentioned, you know, you're in Switzerland. Obviously, Swiss banking is famous and it basically, you know, deep history. And you've mentioned there that you've been part of coming up to create some of the standards and thinking around this. Is Switzerland at a national level doing anything to maintain that lead in banking, if you like, in the crypto era? Are they embracing it or is it too avant-garde for something that's for a country which is known for stability?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, I would say, right? On one hand, of course, Switzerland is home also to what is called the Crypto Valley. So the Crypto Valley is proud of being basically the place where projects like Ethereum, also a major blockchain project, got started. I think there's a quite enthusiastic community available. Okay. But at the same time, of course, if you look at Switzerland and also what's behind the strength of Swiss financial center, you have a lot of large traditional banks, right, and insurance companies. And of course, for them, the emergence of this new tech is also often looked at a bit more controversially because like they look at things, hey, look, if we have now a stablecoin solution, this kind of puts our, it could theoretically replace our services, our raison d'être of existence, right? And that's why, of course, like it certainly took, especially those large institutions, a while to get involved. Same time, it's pretty well documented that even like the large institutions started relatively early experimenting with the technology. this is also a general statement for many European banks, right? That also American banks, Asian banks, that they started testing, hey, how can we basically leverage this blockchain technology, this shared database, to optimize our FX trading, our peer-to-peer markets? Because like a lot of trade actually happens on a regulated exchange. This is really still running on the legacy infrastructure banks were built on probably in the 1970s or 80s. So I think for them, initially was they looked at it more from an operational efficiency management point of view, but started more and more also, of course, like appreciating or differentiating themselves vis-a-vis other competitors. We also know that almost every single European central bank has a pilot running focused on the issuance of a central bank-backed digital currency, right. So a stablecoin which is issued actually by a central bank. So I think there's a lot of activity ongoing, but it's slow. It's certainly because like they do not want to lose control. They don't want to basically push themselves next to, let's say, right. Next to trouble. And at the same time, Switzerland is certainly also like one of the few jurisdictions in Europe where you have crypto-focused banks, also speciality banks, which were able basically to open shops. So there are a few in Switzerland. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's in total 3 banks which have received a bank license, a proper full-scope banking license. And these institutions really focus on the crypto clientele. So that's also another proof that certainly like Switzerland is moving with is open for the industry, is welcome to the industry. But of course, in all fairness, there's also a lot of skepticism around, which is of course, and I think we haven't yet mentioned it explicitly, but of course, there's a reason for a certain reputation of crypto, right? That it was used or is still used by criminals, that it is used for drug trafficking, money laundering, et cetera, et cetera. And we need to get rid of this, let's say, reputation. How can we achieve that? By just be great innovators for the right purpose. And deploy the tech really for this.
Okay. All right. So we've got now to the stage where if you want to use, so it sounds like there are actually banks who can handle your currency, some of them there in Switzerland. So if you still want the certainty of a traditional bank with a banking license, it sounds like they may be able to hold your, although it's not so necessary to hold so much of it if you're doing it for payments, I guess, because you can just have a cash account and then do the transaction instantly and then send it on. But, and then the last question on this side is like, who can really benefit from the extra speed that you get from doing this? Because when I'm doing a transfer, still amazingly, I can send money from myself to my wife, and we're 2 different banks in the same country. It can still take 2 days for some reason. So who can really benefit from the increased speed, or what are the use cases for having faster payments, not just cheaper payments?
Yeah, I think what I have experienced myself in the past and in a few instances, for example, like if you imagine like you want to do business with somebody abroad, you might have not seen this person or interacted with these people before at all, or not too many times. And in order to get going, for example, on providing certain services or acquiring a good, you might be in the position that you need to do like a certain upfront payment, a retainer payment. And some of this basically counterparties insist that they will only start working or transferring a good to you once they have received basically these prepayments. And in such circumstances, for example, it can be pretty handy that within a couple of minutes, you can basically render proof that you have done basically this prepayment. So probably as a simple illustration, because I'm also working in consulting, right? Like you have a client who approaches you and needs your support on a delicate, very time sensitive matter. You haven't been in touch with them before. You know, it's a lot of stuff. It's sensitive. It's complex. And maybe you want to ask them, hey, look, in order to be on the safe side, because we haven't dealt with each other before, I would like to receive this retainer fee. And accepting crypto as a means of payment would allow you that in relatively a small amount of time, you can get basically every confirmation that this payment was made, and you basically can focus on the delivery of your service provision without basically accepting this counterparty risk. That's, for example, I think a simple illustration of the case. Or imagine if you want to buy, because you fancy an apartment in New York, if you plan to buy a place there, but the landlord will only give you the keys once they have proof of the deposit payment. And all your funds sit in Europe.
Yeah.
So you need now to find a way how to bridge this 3-4 days in New York. Probably will find reasons and things to do. But this is probably another illustration. Really, I think any kind of time-sensitive activities. And of course, right, it certainly also helps to streamline general payment operations because if things are quickly done.
Yeah.
It's also helpful.
Okay, so maybe if a particularly intense negotiation or is an advantage to be able to pay fast, you might be able to get some advantage there. So we'll start to wrap things up now. How can people get in touch with you, Kevin? Sounds like you've obviously steeped in the background in here. You got the legal background, you got the tax compliance background. Who can you really help most, if you like, who's listening to this, and how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, no, thanks for this opportunity, this question. And usually I work really with Web3, so crypto projects. So the token issuers, like, or any kind of project that are very active in the space. For example, like really on getting things set up or support throughout the audit. I think for general businesses, like which are not really focused only on this space, right? I think it would be probably more about, how to actually open up to this potential. For example, accepting stablecoins as a means of payment. As part of the treasury management, you want to diversify into such as like Bitcoin, how to basically also come up with accounting guidelines, right? That's certainly also something I have in the past also helped out businesses with, which do not have an exclusive focus on the Web3 vertical. How to find me? Essentially, it's relatively simple. You can find me on LinkedIn or just drop me an email, kevin@3kxyz. That's where you can find me. And I'm happy to come back to you and happy to jump on an initial call.
Very good. If you land on an extremely yellow website, you're on the right place. That's it looks beautiful, by the way. I love it. It really stands out.
It's a bit different.
I'm going to follow you on Twitter, actually. I see you got your Twitter account there. Okay, so now for my final question, which is, who is your business hero and why?
Yeah, it's a good one. Like, probably I'm a bit boring because I say, like, I don't believe in the concept of having a single business hero, but I think I would say I just have admire all these people out there who were brave enough to chase their entrepreneurial dream. I think so. Somebody like you, right? Like building up something from scratch, scaling to a sustainable business. I think that's really what I love to see and what I also hope at some point crypto will walk towards too, because right now it's still very venture-like, but at some point in 5 years or so, we should be also arriving at this state. I think like it's maybe a slightly controversial take these days, but also to maybe bring it down to a single person, maybe a character like Sam Altman, looking back what he has achieved over all the years, knowing of course he's these days in the spotlight, but it's pretty impressive. He's just 5 years older than me, so chapeau, as we say in Switzerland. And I think really being able to switch throughout contexts so quickly and so successfully is pretty impressive. But of course, certainly also like it comes with a lot of also flaws and downsides. I guess he's very much aware of.
Well, entrepreneurship is a controversial one. I think we were discussing at the weekend, just sort of our dinner, about AI and what's happening with AI. And I'm quite excited about it because it means, as I see, AI is, you need to capture value, which is not being captured at the moment. Like you need to deliver value in a way that does not exist at the moment. That's where a lot of the opportunities seem to be for me. Like AI is not so much replacing accountancy teams, and you hear things about but really the big breakouts are the opportunities where there is a service that is possible to deliver that just was not possible before. I think it's a great time to be an entrepreneur, and because this is a whole new tool that opens up a whole range of opportunities that were never there before. So it's going to be fun. Let me listen back to this in 5 years when I've gone out of business and everything's gone terribly wrong because the AI is doing it. We'll see if I succeeded or we all succeeded. Maybe we'll check in, Kevin, see how we made out with that. But cool. So I love it. Chapeau. Thank you very much for coming on the show. And thank you for listening this far into the show. Your special reward for your perseverance and interest in us is to go to procurementexpress.com/partners. There I have a webinar which specializes on telling you more about how Procurement Express can help take the hassle out of managing spend with magical features, specifically if you are a CFO or fractional CFO. And I walk through how you can think about hiring a fractional CFO if it's the first time you're going to do it, or if you are a fractional CFO. I also walk through how to explain the value of a finance professional in a way that speaks the language of an entrepreneur to help you get more clients. So if you're into that, please sign up. Kevin, this has been really packed with insight. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for the opportunity.